VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 417, recorded on March 13th, 2016. Welcome to the 417th edition of the TD Game Podcast and the 250th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am Dan Quick.
And I am Scott Dirk.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast, focused on game news from around the industry. So, yes, this is a milestone episode. This is number 250. And so while TJ is busy bowling, because he didn't know that we were recording tonight...
So that's what he's playing lately.
That's exactly it. And he's playing this unusual VR version of bowling. It's called Real Life.
Wow. Whoa, that sounds overpowered.
Mind-blowing.
Wow. You know, I don't know. You know, I have to wear glasses. I might throw up having to bowl that much.
Yeah.
Or maybe it would be the alcohol.
I guess it's better than the Wii U bowling, right?
Yeah. The problem with this is that if you really make a bad mistake, you could actually injure yourself worse than any Wiimote.
Although, it really isn't this the 250th episode of Video Game Roundtable? I'm not sure you pronounced that properly, Jonah.
250th really official episode. I mean, there are special episodes in which we had to talk about breaking news, like the PSN outage. But this is the 250th named numbered episode. So, yeah. I mean, in reality, it's something like 263 or something like that. I'm pretty sure. I could quickly check the site if I really wanted to.
Whoa. I was invited on the express understanding that this was a special 250th episode. All right, I'm gone.
But it is special because you're here.
Oh, I was hoping someone would acknowledge that. Thanks, Jonah. Well, Scott.
What? Oh, I went out if the effort to invite you to make sure that I spoke to you and got you on and not, you know, just leave it to Jonah to do or something. You know, I wanted you on the podcast.
By the way, if it sounds like they're like an old married couple, Scott and Dan have been on a different podcast together called the Polycast.
Yes, Polycast, Turncast, what else? Oh, yeah, and One More Turn.
Yeah, and what is the podcast that you call it that when you're playing a live session of Civ 5, which
that's
I've done
Turncast.
Like twice.
That's Turncast.
That's Turncast.
Yeah, Turncast Live, which turns into just the post-produced version of Turncast. And Scott is also a regular co-host on Modcast, which is on Civ modding. Turncast is on Civ multiplayer, and then Polycast is just Civilization strategy in general. And Scott is the most frequent guest co-host on that show.
Yeah.
And I'm also on that podcast with the with Willow Lucas-Smith, Candice Albanus, and... blanking on his
that's
name
a weird name. That's, I mean, hey, you know, everyone's got their own username. That must be really confusing on the show when people swear. It's like, wait, with me? No, I'm saying damn it. Yeah, damn it. No, damn it. Who's on first? Who's on second?
You know, the thing about the Turncast is that's the only time in Civilization in which I became a raving lunatic and evil guy. I mean, the Mongols attacked me and I just said, screw it, you're dead. And I just threw everything at them. That's the only time I ever conquered another civilization that early in a game. But Dan can attest to it, I became a beast. I just became, I don't care.
You were the lawnmower, man. We remember.
I'm usually the guy who turtles. For those who don't play Civilization V, that's someone who keeps to their own little empire, building up the technology and trying to win. Alternatively, they're not very aggressive. Normally, that's my strategy. But in this, I just took the hammer of God and just pounded the Mongols in the head. It's like, how dare you?
Hey, Scott, do you want to parse Jonah's statement, or shall I?
Uh-oh.
He's like, you're the lawn, and I'm the lawnmower, or something like that. Right?
Oh, the ass is grass.
Yeah. Oh, your ass is grass, and
ass
I'm a lawnmower.
And I'm the lawnmower.
But what I was going to parse is, Jonah talked about being a raving lunatic and evil. Uh-oh. I mean, that's what you usually are, Jonah. You're just talking about in Civilization V, that was your one instance where you brought that into the gameplay.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Plausible deniability. Well, we'll see how far that goes for you.
So the other thing is that we might have Paul on. He's currently at GDC, which is the big thing. I have never been to GDC myself, by the way, simply because I can't go to E3 and GDC. I have to pick one or the other. And since we're in the meat of the podcast right now, I'm going to say E3 is not looking too good. E3 is looking miserable. I don't know if you know this, but both EA and Activision won't be on the floor. And those are the two major publishers. You don't have EA, you don't have Activision. That and EA is going to be cute and do the Nintendo thing of just being in hotel suites around the thing. You know, if you ever go to E3, they have huge showcases, and that's not going to be there. And I'm, you know, it's like I warned E3. You know, you're starting to get too high on yourself. You know, like they keep on rejecting this podcast and my TV show because it's not big enough for them. Well, yeah, it looks like you're not big enough for EA or Activision.
Wow, I don't know about you, Scott, but Jonah, you having to make the choice between GDC and EA. Can you hear the world's tiniest violin
E3
right now? Yeah, it's playing right now for you. It is.
It sounds like he's answering his own question. If these big publishers aren't going to E3, then go to GDC.
And Nintendo already pulled out, although Nintendo had their own reasons. It isn't the same as EA and Activision. They will probably have their pre-conference thing, but maybe next year I'll go to GDC. And by the way, it isn't too hard to go to GDC. You just have to pay the $140 for the beginner entry fee, you know, and
just
you don't do all the
$140, folks.
And then you
just
have to go to San Francisco.
Just $140. They will cover your travel expenses. Fact.
They will.
I've said fact on the internet, so it's all I have to worry about is $140. Thank you, Jonah.
People pay more for PAX East than PAX Prime. I did not go to PAX East this year, by the way. That show has been declining in my eyes, too. I'm just saying. Anyways, this is not the Jonah's Diatribe podcast. This is actually the video game roundtable. So I will ask Dan, what have you been playing lately?
Other than Town of Salem, which
is
a free-based, and I know, Jonah, you've played this as well. It's a web-based game, but it's also on Steam. It's based on the Mafia card game, where essentially you are trying to deceive while other people are attempting to deceive you. So you might be thinking, how is that any different from real life, Dan? Well,
you know what's weird about it though? It may be based on Mafia, but it has characters who look like they should be in Werewolf. I mean, it's set in a small town, you know, urban town. Why are they worried about the Mafia? Shouldn't it be werewolves? Anyways, go ahead, Dan, with your story.
But in addition to that, and as a matter of fact, right before we started this recording, Scott and I, we were playing Cards Against Humanity using Tabletop Simulator, which Tabletop Simulator itself is an amazing game. Any game that you can think of that you would play with, you know, quote-unquote real people, you can play with quote-unquote fake people over the internet. And Cards Against Humanity is one of those games where I call it, you know, it's debauchery.
It is debauchery.
Town of Salem is frustrating.
Yes. Because people cheat.
There is that. And there's the whole question. We get into metagaming questions with regards to Town of Salem and other games as well. But the thing is, when it comes to Town of Salem and Cards Against Humanity, when I'm tired of conquering artificial intelligence civilizations, I decide to conquer and humiliate real people by playing Town of Salem and Cards Against Humanity, or something like that. Something like that.
Do you play on Godlike against in Civ 5? Just wondering. What is the highest level you play in Civ 5?
Oh, deity.
Deity. Okay.
That's the highest level you can go. I'm an Emperor level player.
Okay. Well, Godlike was, I guess, in the earlier Civ games. I just remember Godlike from. Anyways, the thing is that I actually backed a Kickstarter for Tabletopia, which is like a level up from Tabletop Simulator. So, and I did the $100 thing. So I have a gold room for the next 100 years. So after 100 years, I won't have the gold room again, and I'll have to pay for it like everybody else.
Something tells me you're not going to have to worry about that. I don't mean to get morbid or anything, but
I know I'm only assuming I'll have it for the next 3 years before it becomes an issue.
You just want to burden your descendants with the expense in 100 years.
Way to go! Maybe 4 years.
Everybody
knows that life ends at 50.
Our crippling debt. Let's pass it on to the next generation. Excellent. Well done.
But the thing about Cards Against Humanity is that it is a Media Commons, or what is it called? Wiki Commons, or you know. Anyways, but you could create your own Cards Against Humanity, and you can do anything you want with it, so long as you don't make a profit off of it. So you can make your own cards. You can do anything you like, so long as it's not for profit.
If you really put Civilization references into that, that would be great.
There are hundreds of workshop items for Tabletop Simulator, and it was just under $22 Canadian, so that's like, what, $5 American with the exchange? I'm exaggerating. but it's,
yeah,
not
it's actually $3.
The only thing I would say about it is you need to find people that you either don't know and don't care about, because there are, you know, random games that you can join on Tabletop Simulator, not just Cards Against Humanity. Yeah. Or find a group of people that you know really well so that you'll still be friends after the game is over.
But yeah, I think the latter is better for me, because I wouldn't want to bother with random people. I wouldn't feel as comfortable with random people.
Right. The thing about Tabletopia is that it's being aimed towards board game makers as well. And they have tools that board game makers can use to develop their board games on tabletop. As for me having a gold room, what's good is that I can invite anybody into my gold room. They don't have to be a subscriber. I permanently have a gold room.
So, wow, yeah. I like how Jonah talks about he can invite anyone into the gold room, and neither Scott or I have received an invitation yet. You know, and
well, it's in beta. It's in beta. I can't give invitations until it actually goes live.
Yeah.
Now we're getting the whole story. Now
it's in beta.
I'm gonna feel guilty. Okay.
Sure. But it's a good thing that you like tabletop games, because you know there are several games I really want to see on Tabletop Simulator. Lords of Waterdeep is high on the list, even though I have the iOS app. You know, it's nice to be able to play a virtual board game with other people. That isn't
easy. They have Legend of Zelda Link to the Past on there as one of the workshop items, which I thought was awesome.
Okay. Nintendo's not litigious. We don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about them suing anybody. So you've been playing Lords of Salem, which is basically Werewolf Mafia online. And the reason why I say people cheat, I came up against this one case in which two people were sitting next to each other in a room playing the game. That's a no-no. You know, and the thing is that a lot of people don't understand the rules, like the medium. The medium talks to the dead, right? I mean, but what they don't know, and it's, I don't know, Dan, have they started realizing this? But if the medium is killed, they can actually talk to the living once or twice.
Once, yes, they do have a seance. This
is
true.
Yeah, but they don't know that, so what happens? People quit. And that's the thing, is that a lot of people quit before the game is over, which ruins the experience for a lot of people, you know? And I always stay in because one of the fun parts is if you're killed, you get to converse with – well, if they stay, you get to converse with other people, snarking about them. And you know
– you might win that last, you know, minute that you could get a victory and you don't know.
And also you get to snark at people who accused you. Say, oh, look at me. Oh, yeah. By the way, you offed the guard. You know, what's it called? Thanks a lot. Now we're going to lose because of you. Yeah, well, I never get that snarky, but it's just that, you know –
And in Town of Salem, the major teams are Town and Mafia. And if you quit and your side wins, like most people would quit once they die, and you kind of understand that. But if your team actually wins, you don't get the count for the win.
Yeah.
The game actually will say at the end, these are the players who won. And it's like,
That's a change. That's a good solution.
That is a very good change. I've only noticed that because it's like, wait a minute, there were supposed to be 8 town players. Oh, 3 people quit. That's why only 5 townies won.
Yeah, they should just divide the spoils in which their rewards. Same rewards for everybody, but now people are getting a bigger cut because people quit.
Yeah,
maybe not. But you know, the thing is that when you get coins, you get to buy certain stuff. The one thing I'm going to jump back into Lords of Salem since they now have that anti-quitting policy.
Town of Salem.
The one I really like is, see, there are a lot of execution animations, and my favorite is the one in which just a large bowl just drops on you, plop. That's my favorite. It's like, you're... Because normally, the normal animation for someone getting lynched is that they're hung, right? You know, they just get... There are other stuff.
I think there's a setting them on fire one. And,
yes, but I like the boulder falling. I like the boulder falling from the sky one better. It's so cartoonish.
Yeah.
The boulder one. Actually, the first time I saw that, I'm like, wow, these 15th century people managed to get that boulder all the way up in the air to drop that.
It was God who did it.
Yeah, I guess they're really holding back. They know the technology and using it. It's impressive. But on Town of Salem. I will just also say two things that I would like to see with that game. Number one, there's this knight immunity crap that is just unbelievably annoying. But the worst part, and to Blank Media Games, who does Town of Salem, if they listen to this podcast, or people who listen to this podcast have an ear for Blank Media Games, and I know they've heard this already, but they need to hear this thousands of more times so they actually change it. Either remove vampires, which I'd be fine with, but keeping vampires in the game, that vampires can bite Mafia. Because as soon as you add vampires to the game, and it's vampires versus mafia, unless the vampire gets staked by a vampire hunter in the first night or two. Mm. And it's just I don't want to play with vampires for that reason, because it's a prescribed thing. Just like in any game, if this is in the game, then I know that this path is going to be, you know, it's going to go down this path 9 times out of 10. Well, that's not fun.
Yeah, speaking of trader games, I actually spoke to Travis, who's with, oh, I forgot the name of the company. But they're the ones who do Resistance / Avalon / what's the name of that game? Oku. And he actually told me that, yes, they are going to be releasing they're going to have a computer version of Resistance. And the one advantage that Resistance / Avalon has over Werewolf / Mafia is there is no elimination. There, you know, what happens in Werewolf Mafia, you get killed, you're out of the game. In Avalon / Werewolf, you're on teams and you never get killed. It's just whether missions fail or not. So I'm glad to hear that's coming. It'll be interesting to see that being instituted. So, TJ, what have you been playing?
Oh, I'm sorry. Being on the show.
Yeah, Scott, what have you been playing?
Anyways, yes. Well, like I said, I'm playing a little bit of Cards of Humanity with Dan, but I also was playing...
I find that elderly Japanese people is the catch-all one that'll always get the votes. Also, the box turtle biting the head off your penis is the other one that always gets the votes. Those two are like the instant win cards.
I think there are a lot of sentences I didn't expect to hear when I came on this show, and that would be one of them. Yeah.
Wait a minute, how could you not expect it when you bring up Cards Against Humanity? That's one of the cards. Damn it, those are both cards.
I haven't seen that card yet, but I think we've
really.
Pretty much just choose whatever we feel like. It doesn't really seem to be any hard rule there. You just pick whatever you feel is the winner. So.
Yeah, but I'm just saying those usually get the most laughs in what's it called? It's like they fit everything.
Well, I think the game is kind of subjective, like I said, depending on who's going to say, okay, this is the winner, that's what that person does. So
wait, with the Cards Against Humanity, how many cards are there? Because I have all the cards from up to, I think, number 5 and also the big black... No. I'm talking about sets now, because I have all of them from one from the original through 5 and also the big black box.
The one that's available on Steam that's the most comprehensive has got the expansions 1 through 5.
Okay, so basically the one that's online is basically what I have now. Okay. Just wondering. It's like Dixit, you know. When you only have the one set, it keeps on getting, oh, I've seen these before. You know, at least having all of them keeps it, you know, fresh, that you don't always see the same ones popping up over and over and over again.
We seem to have that habit, actually, having just played about a handful of games over a couple of nights, but it usually ends up being that even if the same person draws the card, you know, the black card where they're going to have to choose from the white card submissions for the winner, that the people are different, or at least some of the players are different, so you don't get exactly the same, necessarily, you know, the same picks. Plus, it's all based on the 5 cards you've got in front of you, but also, like Scott said, it's so subjective, it really helps if you actually know the person as opposed to random, because then you can try to choose a card that not only fits the suggestion, and grammatically so, which can sometimes be difficult if you want to be really particular about that, but you also got to think about, this is the person that's going to be judging it, so again, like Scott said, are they going to find it funny? Are they going to find it funny enough to choose it? But some want the funny ones, they want it clever, they want it, you know, dirty, they want it as unique as possible or some combination thereof. So it's a lot of fun. But,
and in the case of Dan, a Canadian reference.
You know, I just realized that there's one way that online version of Cards Against Humanity beats the offline version, and it's when you get those black cards that have pick 2 and pick 3.
Yeah.
You no longer have to worry about bundling up together. So that they have to go in line, because a lot of times it's a pick 2, forget it. Well, let's go to the next card. You know, at least you can do the pick 2 and pick 3 ones.
Plus, with that, there's also a blindfold feature as well. So the person hits the B button, and then they can't see people placing the cards down on the on the virtual table. Because then it's like, oh, I know where that person is. They put it in the lower left hand corner relative to the black card.
I don't
like that player, or that player's only got one more point to win, so there's no way I'm picking their suggestion. This way, you've got no idea just how deranged the person is.
Have you guys ever played Dixit?
No.
Dixit is basically the impressionistic version of Apples to Apples / Cards Against Humanity, in which you have all these abstract pictures, and some will say time, and then everybody has to put theirs in, and the thing is that if no one picks their card, everybody else scores except the person whose card it is. Or if everybody picks it, everybody scores except the person. So he has to make it so that only one other person is going to guess what his card is, and everybody else is going to think it's another card. So it has to be vague enough for them so that not everybody picks his card, but it can't be completely obtuse that no one picks his card. Really, you should try Dixit sometime. It's really fun. It's basically the same conceit of trying to guess what that person's personality is like and what he would pick, you know, as something like Assholes to Assholes, which, by the way, is Cards Against Humanity's a nickname. Did you know that?
No, but I'm not surprised.
You know what apples to apples, right?
Yeah.
It's the clean version of Cards Against Humanity.
Oh, okay.
So it's what Cards Against Humanity is based on, actually. They just took all the clean stuff and just made it really, really dirty. That's why they call it Assholes to Assholes. Anyways, Scott, you were saying about Cards Against Humanity since we wildly drifted off and interrupted you.
Well, and by we mean Jonah. Yes, so Scott.
Yes, I know. I'm used to it, Dan.
I remember I was regular co-host for almost a year, so yeah, we share that. We share that experience, yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed the just getting all raunchy and messed up with the game, and I wouldn't feel comfortable with random people, so I am glad that I have a gaming group to play this game with, and you just can just go all out on it, because you... I mean, we're kind of used to being raunchy anyways with Turncast After Dark.
You know, but the thing is, if you have people playing Cards Against Humanity... Strangers are going to know what they're in for. They're not going to... They understand what Cards Against... It's not like your grandma's going to play and say, oh, how shocking, you know?
I don't know. There's some grandmas that would play this.
I mean, there aren't going to be grandmas who are going to play it who are going to say it's shocking. Those grandmas who play it are going to say, yeah, check this one out. Oh, I know mine is going to win. And he usually does. So you played anything aside from online Cards Against Humanity?
And I, you know, of course, I always play some Minecraft, some Fallout, and a little bit of Civ. So there's, you know, those games too. So, and I played a little bit of Mickey's Castle of Illusion this weekend too. I managed to get some time into that.
Oh, the remake.
Yeah, for Steam, it's okay. Really nice.
It's still extremely tough. You know,
yeah,
the original
tough.
Nintendo game was tough, but you know, at least they retained that.
I thought it was Sega Genesis.
Let me ask you a question. Maybe. I don't know. Which is more difficult than DuckTales or Mickey's Castle of Illusions?
I think DuckTales is still harder because, like, I can get to the boss, no problem, on Mickey's. But, like, I'll get stuck on levels with DuckTales just, you know, getting killed. So, I don't know. I think DuckTales might still be harder. But they did a good job with this Mickey game, and it reminds me a lot of Mario.
How much did you pay for it? It was like released a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, I can that doesn't matter when it was released. I'm playing it now.
No, I mean, how much is it after a year?
Oh, geez, I guess it was like 10, 20, somewhere in that range.
So still the same amount. Wow, that just tells how popular it is. I mean, they're not going to lower the price until people stop playing it.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I don't know what would be the point, because if it's digital, it's not like you're trying to get rid of stock or anything, you know, like, oh, we got to get this off the shelf, sell for $5, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, you will see those penny sales on digital.
Yeah, it's just some games just seem to stay at a high price. Like, I'm looking at The Stick of Truth is still $30, Kerbal is $40, you know, it's just like, wow, that's really expensive. So, yeah, but it's a good game, and it kind of reminds me of Mario 64, how you had a castle, and you had to unlock doors, and, you know, in Mario, you had to collect stars, and Mickey, you're collecting diamonds.
It's a collectathon, yeah.
Yeah, it's a collectathon, but it's still fun. I think something I've learned about myself is I actually do like platformers when they are 2D or side-scrolling, like the Mickey game.
Okay.
So it is, you know, so... That's what I've been playing. Man.
So what I've been playing Garden Warfare 2 still, and I'm still really addicted to it. I mean, it's everything that a shooter should be, like Battlefield. And it isn't because it's not like gory and violent and all that. It's just balanced really, really well. I've also been playing a lot of the Master of Orion early access. The only issue I have with it is that it's kind of bland. But then again, it is early access. You know, there's like half the content missing. So I mean, there's a bug report or actually, you know, a reaction. I'll just tell them, you know, you got to pizzazz this up a little bit more, you know, because the strategy is a little bit, you know, straightforward, or make the other alien races more aggressive, you know. I've also started playing a preview build. It's actually the finished build. I'm not sure if it's been released yet. Maybe it has been released for Prison Architect for the Xbox One. And I finished the first story thing, which is basically a tutorial, and in it you have to build the electric chair so that someone can get executed. And the cutscenes going on how he got to be on death row are kind of graphic for a game. So there's that. But not enough for me to have any opinion on it. Prison Architect has been out for a while. In terms of they had an open alpha for a long, long while, and finally was released like a couple of weeks ago.
Apparently, Mickey's Castle of Illusion is normally $15, but it's on sale right now for like $3.74. So, wow, that you're right. They do have some very low sales still.
Oh, it looks like Prison Architect is coming to the Xbox One in the second quarter of 2016, but that its original release date was last October, where they had sold over 1.2 million units and grossed over $19 million. Wow.
Prison Architect was a big hit. And it's by Introversion, the same people who did Darwinia, and also that hacking game in which you play a hacker. And in order to play, you really have to learn how to be a real hacker to play that game. It's really obtuse, but also fun. Anyways, we're going to go straight into game news. Bethesda working on a quote-unquote bleeding-edge RPG, and this comes to us from Game Watcher. While Bethesda has started to become a prolific publisher, their development has begun and ended with Fallout and The Elder Scrolls lately. Well, I mean, they also had that shooter. Oh, darn, I can't believe I forgot the name of it. It's a stealth game by Arkane Studios. Anyways, a hint just slipped out about what they're working on next. We already knew, thanks to last month's DICE talk, that the company is working on three new big and crazy games. But thanks to a recently uncovered batch of new job listings, thanks GamesRadar, we know a bit more about what those projects may entail. Each listing suggests they have a team that is pushing the bleeding edge of role-playing game development for the PC and console, so speculate as you choose. While Fallout 4 was a solid game, it wasn't exactly a huge innovator over the previous Bethesda games, so it'll be interesting to see what the studio considers a bleeding-edge project. Of course, given how close to launch Fallout 4 was even announced, it could be some time before we even know more. I remember the last game that Bethesda/id Software considered bleeding edge, and that was Rage, which flopped horribly.
I feel like bleeding edge is one of those corporate buzzwords, like
bleeding edge, not leading edge.
You know,
bleeding
whatever.
Edge. Yeah. By the way, so I'm still getting electric feedback on your.
Okay.
Something is too close to the mic.
I'm not. I'm like a foot away from it.
Okay. Well, anyways, continue on.
Okay. Hold on. See,
oh, there
better.
It went down.
Oh, there we go. That's better.
There we go.
You got it.
Okay.
So you were saying about Bleeding Edge. Why don't you just start your thing from the top?
Okay. Bleeding Edge feels like one of those corporate buzzwords, like synergy or you know, something that doesn't really give a lot of meaning. It just this vague, like power punch, like the Bleeding Edge. Yeah, to the extreme. It's like, what does that mean? You know, what are we doing? You know, it's too vague. You know, and
well,
so
it depends on what you're talking about. Bleeding edge. I mean, are they talking about bleeding edge graphics, like it's going to be 4K, 8K, or something like that? Or are they talking about bleeding edge as in, I don't know, something more like Obsidian does? You know, everything you do has an effect on the world, and they're going to up that, you know, effect, something like that.
Or, I mean, people have been wanting more interactivity and effect in their game worlds with Bethesda. That has been an issue.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, Bleeding Edge, I didn't take as much exception to it as Scott, although...
I don't think Scott took exception to it. I think he just took a healthy dollop of cynicism there.
Well, I would put Paradigm Shift ahead of Synergy in terms of buzzwords that make me go, blah, or buzz phrases. But that part about Dustin Bailey on Game Watcher saying that every listing suggests this... Dear Dustin, absolute statements are absolutely problematic, and you are wrong. Not okay. All job listings actually use that expression. There were 13 job listings that were posted, and 5 of the 13 make no reference to Bleeding Edge. Although I think that the reason they're using Bleeding Edge, besides the fact that they want to try to attract very talented people, you kind of get the idea. If you're going to be doing something that's unique, something that you haven't either seen in the RPG world or the gaming world, or maybe it had been attempted before but had not been successful, and they're going to try to do it again and give it like that Bethesda touch.
You know, I would like to see something other than Fallout and Elder Scrolls. I mean, Elder Scrolls, I'm completely done with. Fallout 4 I completed, but I don't know if I'm going to be picking up the expansions. I may wait to like 2 years when they have this bundle for all the expansions. So yeah, I mean, okay, thank you, Bethesda. I get it. First-person RPG. Great. And I know that Scott over there is a huge fan of the isometric RPGs.
I am. Yes, I've gone on and on about it, I know. But so, I think we've people want is more interactivity and effect on the world, and also just like there are certain things that Fallout and I think even Skyrim fell a little short on, and hopefully this Bleeding Edge will actually be something and not just, you know, some sort of catchphrase or gimmicky. I don't know. We'll have to see, wait and see.
Maybe they'll have people who talk to you that don't act like zombies.
Maybe they'll be, actually talk to you in a way that makes sense, you know, instead of like, hey, I'm walking over to my workbench to work on a gun and not talking to you, but you're going to sit there and act like I'm bothering you and just distracting you from just walking around doing nothing. It's so annoying. It makes no sense. And it makes people want to kill that character and just be like, go away.
Hey, Dan, you want Scott there to be even more upset? Let's talk about how The Force Awakens is a complete rehash of Star Wars. Just watch.
Oh, it is a rehash, yes. It's just not a remake. That's the difference.
It's a remake.
So, although, I will say, and this isn't just restricted to Bethesda, but listen, when you're going to post job requirements, and I think this is also kind of read between the lines, where it talks about the requirements that you need for these positions, but then you also talk about certain things. Where is it that I had here? Oh my gosh, I'm getting
well.
Lost
don't tell me they had. Oh, you must have worked on a 90 Metacritic game in your resume.
Oh, this is it. Here it is. Under requirements, for example, for quest designer, one of those job postings that don't have Bleeding Edge.
Uh-oh.
Game design experience with ship titles a plus. Under requirements. No. That is not a requirement, except you are actually saying it is a requirement. Just say game design experience with ship titles and forget that a plus part, or have a separate category to say, you know, have it not under requirements. But I think what that's saying is if you apply for this position, if you want a hope and heck of getting to the next stage on a quest designer, you better have game experience with a ship title. Just saying, can you post it not quite that way? Because I just find it sloppy.
You know, well, at least they're not saying you have to have a minimum Metacritic rating on your games. I mean, at least there's that.
That is obnoxious.
Remember back when it was you must have an 85 or 90 Metacritic on one of your games, like how well the game reviewed reflected your work personally.
Oh, I think that question's going to come up in the job interview. So, I see you have game design experience. So, what was your Metacritic score? See, they tell you that in the requirements posting, they ambush you when you're in the job interview. And you say, I'm sorry, sir. What's that as a number?
Well, you know, we're going to pull out this ruler here and see how well qualified you are for the job.
That could get you in some. Jonah?
Metaphorical ruler.
Here. But also in terms of the job postings, I'm actually prepared to speculate. I mean, Dustin invited us to in the article, and I kind of want to speculate even though he said so. Even though, not because you said so, Dustin, because I take exception to what you wrote in part of your article.
Actually, you know what? I think I know what the next... You know what would be a Bleeding Edge RPG? Get this. A text-based adventure game, just like Zork. That'll be Bleeding Edge. People have to read.
You got Text Adventure and Pillars of Eternity, so they're kind of one-upping you already, Bethesda.
Yeah. Now here's the thing. Planescape Torment had 200,000 words in it, if I remember correctly, you know, more than a lot of novels. I'm wondering if Tides of Numenera is going to be similar in that
it's... I think it is longer. I think I was reading their updates, and I think it is longer, okay. Yes.
I've been a bad boy. I have not been checking the Numenera updates. So you were about to say, Scott, Dan, close this item out.
A couple of things here. Number one, there's two openings for a graphics program, or one in Montreal and the other in Rockville. And I was looking at the requirements, and there are two additional responsibilities for the Montreal posting, which includes that you will, quote, review codes from other team members. And so I am prepared to say that of these three titles that they're talking about in the article that are big and crazy, that one of these titles, and it's new intellectual property, it's being spearheaded by the Montreal studio. I'm prepared to say that right now. I am reading between the lines. I think it's safe that it's, you know, we're talking about action RPG titles, but new intellectual property for at least one of the three titles. You're going to have modding capabilities because a number of the positions talk about, for example, under programming intern, experience with modding or indie game development.
Go ahead. I'll add this after you're done.
Okay. And so we've also seen in some previous titles about how, okay, we have some modding capabilities, but we would like to add that modding capability once the game has been released. I think you're going to have that modding capability, and it's going to be compatible across all platforms for all the titles from when they are released.
Well, so, yeah, what about Fallout 4? They were supposed to have that. I mean, Bethesda's supposed to have their own version of Steam Workshop, and it still hasn't materialized.
So yeah. I think they've learned from that experience.
Wait, they learned from that experience? They didn't do any experience. This is the problem. They promised this up and down at the Microsoft conference. We're going to have our own modding thing. We're going to vet them and all that stuff. They must have not understood how many mods a lot of their fans can make. I wonder if they're...
No, Jonah, is it the end of time yet? No, so they still have time. Come on now. Yeah, I'm playing devil's advocate big time here right now. I don't actually believe what I'm saying, but it's not the end of time. Did they put a ring on it, as it were?
Yes, they did, actually. They swore up and down. They sold the Xbox One on it.
Dan does bring up a good point, actually, because the fat lady hasn't sung just yet. They are working on more expansions after the first three things that are coming out in the next 3 months. They increased the price of the season pass, so I would assume that means that they are planning on doing more. You know, and that's why they increased it, to get more money for it. I mean, some people might not like that tactic, but
I'm dubious about that. The fact of the matter is, if you ever go to Nexus Mods, has a ton of great Fallout 4 mods. And no one, you know, unless you go to Nexus Mods, you're not going to see them, you know. I mean, I've gone beyond Fallout 4 at this point. You know, I don't really care about mods right now. But it might have been nice to have some of these mods that allow you to skip a lot of the BS that the game forces you to do. I mean, like resources.
Mods that'll shut up Preston and whatnot.
I don't care about Preston. I care about being able to build stuff. You know?
There are mods to do that. We can build different things or build even larger areas because they have that green little restriction field, and you can actually take that away and build pretty far out. But that of course increases the stuff in your area, and that might have rendering issues. So there are pluses and pros and cons to doing that sort of thing.
Okay, so I think what we're saying here is that a Bethesda game is like a news broadcast on television, where the news broadcast tells you, on tonight's show, we are going to have modding. And you think, okay, so one of the first things they talked about. And later in the hour, we're going to talk about modding. Oh, okay. After the break, we're going to talk about modding. And they still haven't talked about modding, but they've got you to watch all of their other 40, 50 minutes of stuff you should not care about to get to the one part that you, in fact, did want.
And it's only a 1 minute condensed report.
Yeah, there's another company that does that. Coltrane! But, you know, we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt this time.
Let's not talk about Capcom and Street Fighter V now. That's an absolute disaster.
Closing out my speculation is going to be this. You're going to have a fourth quarter 2016 official announcement of the new IP. And then in the second quarter, before E3 in 2017, it's going to be released. And then at E3 in 2017, we're going to find out about the second new title. And I'm going to tell you right now, that second new title, I've looked into my crystal ball, and it is clear. It is Elder Scrolls 6. And then the third new title, we're going to find out about Fallout 5 late next year or early 2018 announcement. That is my speculation.
Well, you know, the speculation right now is Elder Scrolls 6 is going to be announced at this E3, which is maybe the only reason why I'm going now. So, Scott, how much coverage do you want me to do of the Elder Scrolls 6?
Oh, lots. Hopefully, you know, well, if it's good and all that.
Well, let me, before we move forward, what do you want to see from Elder Scrolls 6?
Well, I want to see, like, just being able to really affect your world and leave your mark on it and be different from other people's, what they do. I mean, like, one of the things I really like about some of these games that allow you such customization is to see just how different of choice somebody else made and just having that full flexibility as possible. And so, yeah, I'd like to see, you know, maybe, like the next game could be you becoming the emperor or something, and you're leading wars or something. Okay. You know.
So he wants Fable 4. Got it. Okay. So Dan.
Yeah, I should slap you for saying such filth.
Dan, why don't you take the next news item?
Diablo 2 gets first official patch since 2011, and this comes to us from Game Watcher. For those of you still playing Diablo 2, Blizzard has announced a new 1.14a patch for the venerable roguelike action RPG from 2000 that updates the game to run better on modern machines. This patch is the first official update for the game since 2011's 1.13d patch. According to a post on Battle.net, quote, "This update focuses on system glitches introduced by modern operating systems. In related news, you can finally retire those old Power Mac Power PCs." Is there a little bit of bias in there in my voice? Absolutely not. Included with the update is a shiny new installer for OS X, unquote. I like shiny things. This is good. The update also addresses cheat and hack detection that is inevitable with most older online multiplayer games. Quote, "There's still work to be done, but we're making improvements every day," unquote, promises Blizzard. Diablo 2 was released back in 2000 and has been supported over the past 16 years, various updates, some that remove copy protection and CD checking, along with the usual gameplay tweaks. That removing the CD checking actually reminded me of Civilization IV from Firaxis and Take-Two Interactive, where it was almost 4 years after the game came out, almost 2 years after its second and final expansion pack, that they came out with the 3.19 patch. And yes, I still remember the number because, let's face it, I'm a nerd. And it removed that. That was one of the only things it did, but it had such an amazing effect. It made such a difference. It felt like validation from the community that you've been paying attention to what we have said. And seeing as how Blizzard has said, quote, "There's still work to be done," I expect this is not the last official patch we have for Diablo 2. Maybe we're not going to see the next one until 2020, but who knows?
Yeah, I'm going to say something is that I still prefer Diablo 2 over Diablo 3. I never really got that feeling from Diablo 3 that I got from Diablo 2. You know, it was love at first sight. Diablo 3 was like, okay. It didn't feel like Diablo, and it wasn't because of the shiny new graphics. It just felt, well, there was a huge controversy a couple of years ago when someone from the old Diablo 2 game criticized the game mildly, and the producer of Diablo 3 told him to shut the fuck up. So, I don't know, but it's amazing to see a game that old, 16 years, still getting, and not MMO, by the way. I know that EverQuest is still going strong, even Ultima Online is still going strong, but Diablo 2 is just an action RPG, you know? So, how many of you out there really still enjoy Diablo 2?
I got bored of Diablo 2 when I basically started it up with a friend. A couple of friends of us got on there, and we found somebody that, like, directly took us to Diablo, and we beat him, and then I'm like, okay, game's done. I'm done with the game then.
Oh,
and then
the game's said, no, not wait, done like, after
wait,
you do that.
I gotta show you this really cool level. It's the cow level. And I go there, and I'm watching them kill cows, and I'm like, oh my god, this is boring. When people are playing this, they're playing it until they get to level 80 and then selling the character. Are they insane?
Well, you know, the thing is that Diablo, by the way, World of Warcraft is directly inspired by Diablo. I mean, Diablo 2 perfected the loot grab, you know, feel good about that loot sort of thing. Diablo 2, I don't mind playing from scratch each time. It's just fun, you know?
I need more than just loot grabbing. Like I was saying before about affecting the world, being in the world, I don't feel like I'm in that world. I'm just killing some stuff, grabbing loot. People just skip the text.
That's why they call it a roguelike.
Fast forward story, like, yeah, whatever. Give me the loot.
That's why they call it a roguelike. I guess you don't like roguelikes. I was playing Moria back in the day from 1987. You ever play Moria? It's just a bunch of ASCII characters that you're fighting.
I've never heard of Moria.
Wow. Moria, Hack, it has many names. How about you, Dan?
I've only played the original Diablo. I did not pick up Diablo 2 or Diablo 3. And when I bought the original Diablo, I actually had to go to a store and buy it off a shelf. You see, kids, before digital distribution, you actually had to leave the house.
Hold on one second. Diablo 2 was the one, and you may curse it forever for this, that made limited editions a hot item. Because the Diablo 2 limited edition was the hottest item of 2000. I actually, someone forgot to pick theirs up at a GameStop, or was it an electronic boutique? I don't care. And I bought it for $80, and I sold it on eBay for $250, and I regretted selling it.
And that just, I just had this sudden flashback of in the late 2000s, maybe 7 or 8 years after Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri came out, there were copies, unopened, still in the shrink wrap copies, going on eBay for almost $300.
For Diablo 2?
No, for Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri.
Oh, I still have that.
And it's just kind of like, wow. Although, Scott, you did say you think someone was insane getting up to level 80 and selling that particular character. My question is, how many hours did they have to sink into that character, and how much money did they get for it? Because then you could figure out how much money they made an hour. They might have made a pretty penny.
Oh, and they must have also had the really elite armor, you know, the yellow sets, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think it took them a long time, and I don't know, maybe they knew how to spam up the levels, and I think characters were going maybe for 500, but it's like, you would have to be producing a lot of characters, and that just seems really boring.
They just have liquid money. I mean, some people, 500 isn't that much to them, and they don't want...
some people, yeah.
And here's, well, let's get back to the article, the item itself, and that is, it's nice to see a publisher take care of a game for 16 years. I mean, Knights of the Old Republic 2? I mean, what did LucasArts do? They said, oh, well, whatever. We're going to ship it out. But we want to patch it. Screw you, LucasArts said, screw you. We're not going to patch it. We'll patch it for free. No, we don't want it patched. A year later, we don't want it patched. Didn't you hear us the first time? Leave it broken. Only fans are allowed to fix it.
It's not broken. It's a feature.
It does tie into the previous article where we were talking about what was Bethesda's long-term plans, and I think that might be one of those things where they're going to keep supporting this game a lot longer than they usually would. I think Blizzard does do this because
I thought you were talking about the original
box code that you got with the box for like World of Warcraft 3 or StarCraft games, you can download them off of the Blizzard website. That's what I do for like my old World of Warcraft 3 games. I can download them because I have the old game codes.
Isn't the first StarCraft one free?
I'm only laughing because I honestly thought that's not what Scott was going to say. I thought Scott was going to be like, this ties into our previous discussion about Bethesda, where they keep delaying adding modding capabilities for Fallout to tick off the community. So that's obviously what LucasArts is doing with Knights of the Old Republic. It's like, wow, okay.
I don't know. I'm just glad that they continue to support it. You know, I forgot where I was going with this, so we're just going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay. Forza Motorsport 6. Apex won't cross-play with Xbox One version. This is from Game Watcher. Last week, Microsoft announced a free-to-play version of the popular Xbox One racer Forza Motorsport 6. The Windows 10 game was given the subtitle Apex, while most Windows 10 version of the game Xbox One titles, such as Killer Instinct, feature crossplay, Apex will not. Microsoft has announced. When asked about crossplay with Apex, marketing boss Aaron Greenberg answered, "No, it is a curated experience designed for Windows 10," adding, "We want to enable where we can, take time to build the ecosystem. Getting it on Windows 10 is the first step. It's not surprising since Forza Motorsport 6 Apex is a different game than its predecessor. It's free to play and has less content than Forza Motorsport 6. The crossplay will probably be available for the next edition of the series, as the publisher promised that Forza Motorsport 7 will be a full game for Windows 10. Forza Motorsport 6 Apex will launch on Windows 10 for free sometime this spring 2016. So this sounds like Madden number 60, whatever the heck, who cares?
16 and a half.
Yeah. I'm like, here's another one. Here's another one. Here's another one.
You know, the thing about this is the only reason why I mentioned this is that Microsoft keeps on doubling down on Windows 10 now, and it's the fact you have to stress that this is going to be for Windows 10, not for Windows 8, not for Windows 7, all that stuff. I hope you got your Windows 10 for free like I did.
I did. I downloaded it.
Yeah.
No, I'm still holding out. I'm, you know what? I'm fine with Windows 7. It ain't broke. I'm not fixing it.
You know.
Now, Microsoft, I will say I very much like your ad that comes up on booting, and I saw it again for the last week where you talk about the features of Microsoft 10, and then the last item is like reinforced concrete, and it doesn't have the X checked or put with an X beside it. That was very clever marketing. But I view this Forza Motorsport 6 Apex as, so you haven't upgraded to Windows 10 yet. You want to upgrade now, right?
You know, I'm going. Paul's not here, so I'm feel compelled to say this in his absence. You're gonna pull Windows 7 from my cold dead hands.
I don't even think he's on Windows 7. He's XP still.
Oh, that's right. You're gonna pull Windows XP from my cold. Whatever he says that about the OS that he's using now.
Yeah.
You're gonna pull it from my cold dead hands.
Oh. Okay. So is now. I read this and I think, okay, so Forza Motorsport 6 Apex is for Forza Motorsport 6. Tough tongue twisters there. Is that like what Fallout Shelter was for Fallout 4? So you've got the quantity over quantity of time spent as free to pay, but pay for privilege through either microtransactions or grinding.
No, it's going to be a complete. Here's the thing: it's going to have like over 60 cars, 12 races. What it essentially is basically a demo. You know, it's like this. This is a little small taste of what's coming up in the future. It's sort of like when they gave away Portal for free before Portal 2 came out. You know, it's like this is a taste of what's coming up soon. You know, it doesn't require too much effort to port a game from the Xbox One to the Windows 10 anyway.
I want my demos on a CD shipped with my gaming magazine. Thank you very much. You see, kids.
Oh, I miss those days, Dan.
You see, there were these things called magazines.
That's right.
And
you know,
what you would do.
What's funny is I got Ultima 3 and Ultima 4 each separately on a disc. And now when I look at Ultima 4, the entire game is a 784 kilobyte file.
Yep.
Makes you feel small.
But this is related, and I couldn't get into this, but we had this brouhaha like a week and a half ago about someone from Epic Games saying that the Windows program, which is basically the Windows version of Unity, which allows you to make a game that's going to be for the 10, Xbox One, mobile phones, and all that stuff, is Microsoft's, you know, is destroying the game industry. And I'm thinking, you know, if someone else did this, they'd be praising them. And I have to ask them a question: what games are going to be for the Windows Phone that people are going to want to make? It's not like they're forcing people to buy stuff from the Windows 10 store. It's just, I don't know. I just found it incredibly silly. But, you know, people, all you have to do is say Microsoft is doing something bad, and you'll have fans foaming at the mouth for whatever reason.
Wow, but some people claim that it's going to break gaming and destroy the gaming industry. Look, Microsoft, you're no E.T. the video game.
Yeah, and they're not, like I said, it's not gonna slap your hands away from Steam. Like, get away from that. You can only use the Windows 10 store now. Stop. That's not going to happen. Anyways, we're going to move on to more important news, at least I know, according to Scott. Nintendo explains why only the new 3DS plays Super Nintendo games. And this comes to us from Techno Buffalo. During its most recent Nintendo Direct, Nintendo announced that the Super Nintendo Virtual Console Library would slowly be making its way to the Nintendo 3DS eShop. They rolled out the first batch of games. The catch? You can only be played on the new Nintendo 3DS. Nintendo finally clarified why that's the case with Game Informer. The reasoning? The stronger CPU of the newer version of the handheld. This is what a representative told them. As previously announced, the new Nintendo 3DS has an improved CPU which enables Super NES games to run on the system with quality results. The Super NES games also include perfect pixel mode, which allows players to see their games in the original TV resolution and aspect resolution. And now, Scott, you may curse the living hell out of the representative.
Yeah, speaking of forcing you to buy an upgrade, I mean, like, really, I've been playing SNES emulated games on my computer since, like, 1996 or something.
Well, don't they emulate the Nintendo 64 games on the 3DS?
Yes, you can. Oh my God, yes, they do. I can play Ocarina of Time. They've had Ocarina of Time shoved up my ass in so many versions on so many damn platforms. Like, hey, but
whoa, that's TMI there.
There's another article where they're going on and on about how the Ocarina was their big mainstay game. I'm like, what about Link to the Past?
Well,
like,
but that's my point, is that the Nintendo 64, forgive me if I'm wrong here, isn't Nintendo 64 a more advanced machine than the Super Nintendo?
Yes. It's like, this is ridiculous, Nintendo. The hell?
Dan, I know you researched this. Want to throw in?
No, I agree. I mean, the reasoning about the stronger CPU and the newer version of the handheld, the reasoning, we would like some more money now.
Yeah.
This is what our marketers told us that we needed to do, and we had to restrict it in this way so you would actually go out and buy new hardware, even though the hardware you have right now is perfectly fine. And I cannot help but that I'm really kind of getting into the parsing here, where it talks about running the system with quality results, and you get see games in the original TV resolution and aspect resolution. You know, at some point, it's like with high HD on TV. You know what? I don't need to see the blackheads and the whiteheads on the actors' faces any more clearly than I already do. I don't need to see up someone's nose. Okay, I really don't. At some point, it's good enough.
I will say this, though. The thing that they're saying is BS, but it is true that some emulators can't get the Nintendo, the original NES right, and you'll have weird artifacts and all that stuff because it was running on a certain kind of... And some of the best emulators replicate what it was like to play an NES on a regular TV, right? You know, because otherwise it looks funny. But this is BS.
It is bullshit. I mean, they have games that, they're running N64 games, Ocarina of Time, and I think there's a couple other 64 games on the Nintendo's Virtual Console, and I think they have had SNES ones. I think they've had some Contra games, and I think there was a Turricane. I don't know.
You'd have to look that up. I mean, it's ridiculous. Yeah. The thing is that, fortunately, I have not purchased a 3DS yet. So if I do buy a 3DS, at least I'll get the new 3DS, and it won't be like I'm trying to... they're forcing me to upgrade, because you can't upgrade something you didn't have. Oh, they're upgrading me from the DS.
It was Breath of Fire 2. That's what I had on the Wii. That was Super NES, and it worked just fine.
I looked it up. The new 3DS is larger.
Yep.
And I think it has some bells and whistles that the 3DS doesn't have. So, you know, at some point I may pick up the 3DS. The only thing I'm wondering about is the 3DS the Nintendo's last handheld?
I also would want to know if I have an old 3DS, if I can transfer...
I'm pretty sure GameSpot will allow you to upgrade, and you, like, pay something like $50 for it. I don't know.
Yeah, to transfer my stuff to the new console.
No. Are you talking about the eShop? I don't think so. I mean, I don't think they tie in the eShop stuff. You know, with Microsoft and Sony, you buy something once. All you have to do is say, put in your password and say, okay, you can download it again. I don't think a Nintendo does that. I think, you want to re-download Zelda? $5, please.
Yeah.
Give me $5 for Zelda.
It sounds like that this was Nintendo's plan B. Nintendo plan A, which was to have Nintendo employees go to everyone who bought the previous 3DS and smash it against the wall. They realized that was going to take too much time and money and could get them into legal trouble. So this was the next best thing. What? My console is working just fine. Bam. Are you sure?
This one's better. God,
this one's better. This one I didn't smash against the wall. Oh. Nintendo, just let consumers decide. Seriously. I mean, if when you force people into doing something like this, if you want to play this, then we force you to do this. But what I have is perfectly acceptable. Did you ever think that perhaps for every one person that, well, we need more people to play? Well, fine, but if you're getting new customers, but you're pissing off old customers, you're probably not that far ahead, because for all the technology in the world, word of mouth is a pretty big deal still. And, I mean, again, I haven't crunched the numbers, but, I mean, it just, it stinks. It does not seem the way to go about it, because rather than talking about why your new platform is better, you're just going to have, you're just going to be inundated with press and marketing and conversation about this forcing people to go to this new platform just because. And that's really not what you want the focus to be on. You want it to be positive. Not all PR is good PR.
So, going with bad PR now, this is the this is the serious part of the podcast. We're now doing the official serious part of this podcast. I'll read this article because it's a long one, and then you two can throw in once I'm finished. The U.S. Department of Justice increases hostility towards Apple in latest court filing, and this comes from Tom's Hardware. After Apple's own filing 2 weeks ago, Apple Inc.'s motion to vacate order compelling Apple Inc. to assist agents in search and opposition to the government's motion to compel assistance, and its win in New York court against the FBI in a similar iPhone unlocking case, the Department of Justice seems to have ramped up the hostility against Apple in a recent San Bernardino court filing. The Department of Justice went so far as to threaten Apple that if it doesn't comply, and it may even demand Apple release its iOS source code as well as its cryptographic signatures for the OS, going against its own recent public promise that it, quote-unquote, doesn't seek a master key from Apple. Getting Apple's signing key for iOS updates would represent exactly that. The Department of Justice also continued to attack Apple over the increasing the security of its devices so, quote-unquote, the government cannot search them. This rather clearly misinterprets Apple's strong focus on securing its devices against any sort of vulnerability. For instance, without PIN protection that the FBI and Department of Justice now want weakened, any hacker or thief can much more easily unlock an encrypted device, given the right tools, which can be easily found online. Therefore, simply wanting to avoid such a scenario doesn't mean Apple did despite the U.S. government. If we accept that logic, then just about any security patches that fixes a software flaw that the U.S. government is also exploiting could be seen as an action against the U.S. government's interests. In other words, if you patch Angry Birds, you're attacking the U.S. government. The Department of Justice once again said the case has nothing to do with precedent and that Apple is the one trying to make it more about just this one case. However, as we've seen before, many more local and federal law enforcement officials are waiting in line to unlock other iPhones and hoping the FBI will win this case against Apple. Beyond unlocking iPhones, it could also set the precedent for the government to demand just about anything from any tech company under the All Writs Act. Although the Department of Justice keeps repeating that this case isn't about precedent, it's really acting as if it was, as it's going to great lengths to defeat Apple in this one case. This is happening despite the fact that the terrorist destroyed his personal phone, but left his work phone intact, which means that there isn't likely anything of value in there for law enforcement. As the ALCU, or ACLU, I'm sorry, the ACLU... Yeah, ACLU. Why did I say ALU? And others have mentioned, if the FBI thought the information was so critical for national security, it could likely get the NSA's help to unlock the device or unlock it itself by hacking the hardware. However, the FBI and Department of Justice seem to want this to be easy and wanted to set a precedent in court, too. In a conference call, APRA's Senior Vice President and General Counsel Bruce Sewell said the Department of Justice has become so desperate that it has thrown all decorum to the wind. He also added that the tone of the brief reads like an indictment and that it's a quote-unquote unsubstantiated effort to vilify Apple. Okay, you two can now go on the rampage.
I don't know. The more the Department of Justice talks about it, it has nothing to do with precedent. By the way, did we mention it has nothing to do with precedent? Hey, it has nothing to do with precedent. You seem to want to spend an awful lot of time talking about what it's not. And if it really is not about precedent, then why are you pursuing this through the courts when legal system in many countries, democratic countries, is founded on precedent? So you've got laws that are passed by legislators and then interpreted by judges. And then to try to understand a like case or a similar circumstance in the future, judges need to look for precedents, because if they don't, then you can get inconsistent rulings and it's a basis for appealing. And if we want to get really meta here, it then starts being that, oh, well, a judge can just interpret anything they want any which way. So there's no consistency. So therefore, you have a distrust to go along with the increasing misunderstanding of what is actually law. This, I mean, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But to me, this is kind of like an elaborate scheme of, hey, glove manufacturer, your gloves were used in a crime. You're bad. So we want you to tell us how you make these gloves. I know it's not the greatest comparison, but essentially what you're doing is you're not going after the people that have used it inappropriately. Anything that anyone makes can be used as a weapon, or honestly, anything that anyone says.
Well, couldn't we just say paper? Paper? People write things on paper.
Yes, and you can also take that paper, and you can get some wicked paper cuts. Those things sting, man.
Well, they can also write things on paper, like how to make a bomb. Whose fault is that? Is it the paper manufacturer whose fault it is? Your paper was used to make a bomb. No, they wrote on how to do it, so you're at fault
there.
That's
a good point, Jonah, actually, because there was – I remember when 9/11 happened and people were all up in arms about how the terrorists supposedly used Microsoft's flying simulator to learn how to fly. And so
Microsoft
is now responsible, which made
no one could learn to fly using Microsoft. That's like saying you'd learn a car or drive a car by going around in a green machine. No, I mean, for one thing, this is getting way off.
People said it, though, Jonah.
I know.
That's –
train their people how to fly. But the thing that I find, is that, if you really wanted to crack this one, it's very easy. Get a search warrant, and then hire some hacker like the article says, to crack it for you. There are plenty of hackers who will hack the iOS, an iPhone for you.
Oh, but I thought iOS was immune to hackers and viruses. But that's getting off the.
You can hack it just so much, right?
Oh, I'm sure you can hack it, but anyways, the one of the best parts is in that article where it stated that the terrorist or the suspect destroyed the phone that had his information. If somebody has a phone and they know that it has stuff on it, people coming after them, don't destroy it.
Stupid Tom Brady.
It'll be a disposable phone. Or better yet, it won't even be an iPhone. It'll be like a Samsung or something else. And he's like, this is not going to work. And another thing that I thought was interesting, since we have somebody that's not American who might be able to bring up the
– not American.
iPhones are everywhere. They're not just in America. They're in other countries. And there's other phone companies that are all from Korea or wherever. So – this might be trying to set a precedent for them to go to other countries to confiscate phones or something.
No, there's something we like to call jurisdiction. But yeah. Of course, mm-hmm. Dan's not from U.S. Haven't you heard him saying a boot all the time during this podcast? Come on.
I know that's what. I meant he can add perspective, Jonah.
No, I get that. The thing is that this is kind of scary, and I'm pretty sure that they're going to be defeated. But one thing that America has not done is we have not made any laws regarding electronic devices, internet, or anything like that. We still have not declared any laws. That's why you have the DMCA. It's antiquated and it doesn't really work. Like I said last week, what they need to do is they need to declare the internet a public utility, like electricity and water. Without the internet, if the internet went down tomorrow, a lot of bad things will happen.
Really? Because I'm not sure about that. I don't think.
No, I'm not talking about commenters. We're not talking about YouTube commenters. No, I mean, there's a lot of things that depend on the internet to run.
It's one of the it's kind of one of those situations.
I've never heard life before the internet. I know.
Well, put it this way: if the internet going down, it'd be sort of like the phones going down. There's a lot of communication that happens. I'm pretty sure the U.S. Postal Service would love it if the internet went down. I mean, people have to start writing letters.
I mean, the internet has gotten to a point where in a way, the medium is the message. In addition to the message that the medium is carrying, because. Whether it's real or perceived, as soon as there is a disruption of internet service somewhere in the world, there is a ripple effect. And okay, there's some short-term outages and whatnot, but I think on the legal aspect,
it's an issue where the law, and I understand that the law is trying as best they can to stay caught up with technology, and it's not easy. And you try to read in existing laws to new and emerging technologies, just like you try to look at previous cases and say, oh, well, in that particular case or in the case of this law, the people who are writing this law, their intent was that it would apply to this particular technology or this application of the technology. If only they knew about that technology that was decades, maybe even centuries before they were even alive. And that's difficult. But rather than focusing on their own issue, which towards like what Joan is saying, actually amending existing laws or creating new laws that are very explicit about these certain things, that they are going – they're reacting. And in reacting in this particular case, going after Apple, because it is easier to go after Apple because you can upfront identify this company. They are making these products.
You know, you know what this reminds me of, though? I remember a couple of years back, there was a criminal who was on World of Warcraft, right? He escaped, and he decided, I want to play my World of Warcraft. And law enforcement spoke to Blizzard and asked them to help them find him, which they did. They did not ask to break into World of Warcraft and allow him to hack the servers and look through everybody's information to find this person. They cooperate.
That's right. It's how you approach it as well. It's like, I understand the intent, but if someone says, hey, can you help me find my lost dog? Or I'm going to punch you in the face if you don't help me find my dog. You know what? People are going to react differently to those requests, even though your ultimate goal is to find your dog. Okay, Scott. Or some other pet that you love. It doesn't have to be a dog.
Scott?
Scott? I was just thinking how, like, what should the internet be declared? And I think it might there might be precedents to declare it, kind of like how we have international waters, maybe make it something like that where it's like nobody's real territory.
Because here's the thing. You have China and Australia. Big stories about them trying to control flow of content. You know, Australia, even shockingly, because that's a democracy, and they're trying to block everything. You cannot look at these sites. You know, and by the way, that's the entire brouhaha we still have over. Oh, damn! I forgot the word. Dan, you probably remember what it's called. The thing in which people were concerned about throttling and all that stuff and. Net neutrality. There we go.
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had that entire thing, and you know the thing is that we still don't have that resolved either. It's just put away for another time, but it's still looming out there. You know.
I mean, the information that is out there, the information that is stored on phones, the information that is transmitted between phones. I mean, we talk about, you know, like cloud computing, like it's out there in the cloud. Well, it is a physical server somewhere, and that physical server is located in territory of a country.
Yeah.
And so in addition to the jurisdiction part we also talk about, there's also this enforcement question as well.
I think you might want to consider it sort of like the UN, you know. But people actually own those servers, though. Was it – no, it's not Sun. I forgot who owns them, but it's their own. You know, the thing is that if you declare – one of the things that if you declare the internet a public utility is that it would instantly end throttling because that would be completely illegal. And you'd have to have – you couldn't have, oh, you have this amount of – bunch of gigabytes of high speed, and then we throttle you down. No, it always have to be on.
Well, it would certainly end the legality of it, but the practice of it and trying to get caught up and then enforcing it, that's another question altogether.
Oh, no, it's easier to spot someone throttling. I mean, when they found this building that I remember this hotel had a device that throttled people's cell phones – forcing them to use their paid Wi-Fi, that was caught pretty quickly. I mean, you can tell immediately when something's being throttled, especially if it's a Wi-Fi for your phone.
I mean, this thing with the Department of Justice and Apple and access to the information and who owns the information and who has access to the information, it just seems like the next generation of, you know, when you purchase software, you don't actually purchase the software, as in, I own this software now. Well, actually, you own a license to the software. Just like when you lease a domain name, you don't actually buy a domain name. You don't own the domain name. You lease the domain name. And that has legal ramifications and implications that in casual conversation, we kind of talk about them being one and the same thing, and it's not.
Yeah, I still can't get JonahFalcon.com without having to shell out $800 for it.
Wow, that's ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, at least for me. I mean, if I get rich, then it won't be, but till then. Cyber Squatters.
Well, then maybe you just need to look at JonahFalcon.net, some other extension.
Yeah, you know, JonahFalcon.net is also high priced. I'd have to get something like JonahFalcon.us or Jonah-Falcon.com, that sort of stuff.
Well, see, part of the problem, Jonas, you already made yourself so infamous. I mean, famous.
Yeah. I know, you were talking about my extension already, so I mean, I got that joke. I just didn't respond to it.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, all I want is, oh, man, I forgot where I was going with this. Getting back to the – let's wrap up on our opinions on Department of Justice. Go ahead, Scott.
Oh, basically, it's crap and it's stupid and it's going to be incredibly ineffective. And there are just so many phone providers out there now trying to clamp down on one provider. It's just going to make them ensure that the terrorists don't use Apple and they'll use something else. And they probably already are using something else.
Well, the thing about this is that if this goes against Apple, then it's going to apply to all devices, all phone devices. So, yeah, that's an issue. And also, they also hinted at this, but, you know, when you can't patch things without, you know, you'll have to clear things with the U.S. government to patch something?
Well,
really?
You won't be able to hack a phone that's been smashed to bits or thrown in a microwave or thrown down into water or whatever, however they choose to destroy it.
That's the Tom Brady method.
Yeah. Well, hey, it works, you know.
Scott, Dan.
You know, when it comes to situations like this, and I get what they're trying to do, you're trying to keep people safe. And it's a balance of individual rights versus collective rights. And at some point, you're either going to say that these individual rights can be infringed upon because there's a collective right consideration. But then at the same time, collective rights cannot extend to the point where you then say individual freedom has been unjustly exercised, and what's unjust and what is reasonable are open to interpretation. But when you have a government, a democratic government, going to a private company and threatening through legal action and in the public domain as well that we are going to do this and we are going to do that if you do not comply, it does not pass the smell test.
Let me ask you a question. Actually, this, you know, I just realized something, and I think Scott brought it up before. What if, say, you're a Canadian, like Dan, and you bring your iPhone into the U.S.? I mean, it's not U.S. property. Are they allowed to check your phone then if it's made into a law? Or suppose you're in Canada, you know, and what happens to Apple? Say, well, you know, in the U.S. they have this law, but in everywhere else they don't. So we're just going to sell – are they going to say we're just going to sell iPhones to countries that don't have that silly law?
If I, as a Canadian, go into the United States – then I need to be aware of what the law is in the United States, where it differs from Canada, within reason.
But now I'm thinking about sales. I mean, that's going to crimp sales in the U.S. for the iPhone, and maybe they'll say, you know what, we don't need you. We'll just make it $50 more expensive and sell it everywhere but the U.S.
Oh, there you go. And then what people could do is rather than buying it from, you know, Apple in the United States, they could just buy it from Apple in Canada. And
yeah,
then
it'd be like getting a free health care, you know, when you go across the country. I'm going to go across into Canada to get some free health care and then come back again. I'm going to go into Canada to get my iPhone and come back again.
And now I've just got the episode of The Simpsons in mind when they came to Canada and Homer stepped out in the middle of traffic in Toronto. Marge's like, Homer, what are you doing? He gets hit by a car. Woohoo, free health care. It's like, Homer.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite work like that.
Yeah. So this has been the 250th episode of the Video Game Roundtable. Look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with the industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy feedback, send us comments on our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at gamingpodcast.com/gamingpodcast or the forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum or send your comments to fans@gamingpodcast.net. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave some iTunes comments. I am Jonah Falcon, at Jonah Falcon. Is my Twitter. Scott there is at Alpha Shard on Twitter, and Dan doesn't have a personal. He just likes to go with the Polycast to primp up his website, his podcast, which he already did earlier in the episode, actually.
Look, Jonah, I have not yet mentioned the Polycast.net at the Polycast.net because the Polycast.net. Yeah. So you really do? You don't have anything on me there at all?
Well, by the way, I have been on the Polycast.net. Not that often, maybe once or twice or three times, you know. I remember when I did it really early because I was the one who was, you know, I remember way back with Apolladin was I got a copy of Civ, what was it, 4, and I started releasing screenshots from the build.
Yes, and for those in your listening audience wondering, what a Appleton Civilization site is a Civilization fan site, and I was a co-founder of that back in 1998. So yes, perhaps before even some of your listeners were even born, Al.
Is it a zombie site, or do people still contribute? Because I know Appleton.net is there if I go to it.
Appleton Civilization site is a Civilization fan site that is still online.
Oh, okay. And do they still have a listing for Sid Meier's Dinosaurs?
No. When Sid Meier's Dinosaurs was canceled, that section remained on the site, but then the site was redesigned after I left, and that section was archived. Although you could still find that if you go on the Internet Archive Wayback Machine.
I hope Sid Meier revisits that. I mean, he will make a lot of concepts and abandon them because they're not fun, but somehow I think a Civilization dinosaur game might be fun.
The Civilization 2 expansion Fantastic Worlds allows you to play with dinosaurs.
Yeah, I know, but really getting into it. Oh, you know, that reminds me, I reinstalled Spore just to see
why,
because here's the thing. Lately, there was a lot of people blaming EA for what Spore became, and I had to tell them, no, it was Chris Hecker who did that. It was the science versus cute faction. The cute faction was led by Chris Hecker, and the science section was led by Ocean Quigley, and the cute won out, right? And people, no, it was Sid Hecker's fault, it was Will Wright's fault for listening to Chris Hecker. You know, and people, because they're watching the old video of Spore. So why isn't it like, oh, it's EA's fault? No, it's not EA's fault. Not everything is EA's fault, darn it. It was Chris Hecker's fault. So I installed it, and, you know, my opinion has gotten worse on it. I mean, the first phase, you know, when you're a Paramecium or whatever, it's still okay, but everything else is just bad, and it's gotten worse.
It's gotten more gameplay footage. I thought this was the trailer for the new Michael Bay film.
I guess I'll try and find a planet that, you know, if you, they had a little Easter egg that one of the planets would start singing the mule song. You people don't know mule.
I could not get into that game at all.
I wanted so much to get into it,
so
but
sad.
I mean, the thing is that if the science faction had won, you couldn't just willy-nilly change your creature. No. You had to do specific changes. And, you know, the thing is that also the body models, I mean, if I made a long, tall creature, his legs would wobble around like a cartoon character. It was just really off.
Should have made sense.
And then you make friends with other characters, and you could actually go through an entire creature's entire creature's era without ever eating, because the only reason why you need to eat is to recover from damage, so you could build creatures that didn't need to eat. So yeah, it's depressing to play Spore.
Anyways. Yeah, I have no desire to play that game.
Dan, did you ever play Spore?
No, I avoided it.
Okay.
Good for you, Dan.
And I got the special edition of Spore.
Oh, man.
You know, Joni, you generally want to brag about good things. So,
yeah.
I don't know if I'd be sharing that with the world.
You know, the Spore special edition, it's called the Galactic Edition, weighs like 5 pounds. Because it has all these books in it. And the books are nice, but the Spore is crap.
Books are nice,
yeah. The game is crap.
Ultima's special edition when
Ultima
9 came out.
Oh, I love Ultima 9.
Ultima 9
was the Elder Scrolls before the Elder Scrolls. just very badly made. You know, had Ultima 9 had the tech that we have now, I'm pretty sure it would be a classic. Unfortunately, it came out and the tech was not good enough for it. So,
I don't think it was the tech. It was just really badly made. It was really shoddy.
Yeah, because the tech wasn't... they were trying to do the Elder Scrolls with, what was it, 1998? 1997 tech. That wasn't going to happen.
If they had stuck to isometric, they probably would have been fine. And I know I harp on about it, but for the tech time, isometric would have worked better for them.
Did you like Ultima 8? Just out of curiosity.
Not really.
Okay. Because when I bought Ultima 9, I got the collector's edition, which means I got all the previous.
Yeah, I think you get all the games.
All the games.
You buy it.
Yeah. I try to get. You know, The funny thing, I tried to get into Ultima 5, but I couldn't. I don't know why. Maybe it's just the tech wasn't there. Anyways, we've delayed long enough. This is probably stuff that's going to be in the outtakes. So anyways, thanks for coming on, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome. Good to be back.
Yeah, we could have had TJ, but he's just going to have to listen to the episode.
I guess so.
I don't know. I see when I am a guest on this show, I seem to be the third person. I replace someone who isn't here. First it was Paul, and then at times it was Jordan, and now it's Teddy. That's just my special ability. That's my unique ability.
Yeah, but TJ is just enjoying his bowling. TJ is bowling. We should be bowling. Let's have virtual bowling. Anyways, thanks for coming on, and we will see you next week, but not Dan.
Game on.
See you later.
Happy gaming, everyone.